The story we're about to examine is more vivid than a soap opera. It's full of colorful personalities. There's a mixture of joy and tragedy and sorrow. It's a true story that involves sex, religion, and politics in the sense of who's in charge of what. I'd like to start by turning to Matthew 1 and verse 1. Matthew 1 and verse 1. And this is a recitation of who the ancestors are of Jesus Christ. And it says, the book of generations of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. In other words, descended of. Verse 2, Abraham begat Isaac, Isaac begat Jacob, Jacob begat Judah and his brethren. And then verse 3, and Judah begat Perez and Zerah of Tamar. I want to stop right there. There are 14 through verse 14, there are ancestors that are selected ancestors of Jesus Christ. Doesn't have all of them, but there were five women that are listed in that genealogy. We're going to take a look at one of those women to see why she was listed in that select list of women. First of all, I want to call attention to the women who were not listed in that writing. Not listed was Eve, the wife of Adam, the first human mother. Not listed was Noah's wife. Not listed was Sarah, Abraham's wife. Not listed was Rebekah, Isaac's wife. Not listed was Leah or Rachel, the wives of Jacob. And yet Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and Mary are listed. And there's something in common among these five women, namely that under ordinary circumstances, they shouldn't be there. We're going to examine the life and lessons regarding the first woman listed in Matthew 1, a woman named Tamar, because there are profound lessons for us today from the story of her life. We're going to see some of the reasons she was listed as an ancestor of Christ and how the lessons then of Tamar apply to our Christian lives. The title of this message is The Story of Tamar. Well, the story of Tamar has more twists and turns than your average mystery novel. They say truth is stranger than fiction, and this story of Tamar's life is rarely, if ever, told, probably because it's terribly awkward, extremely embarrassing, and often unseemly. The story of Tamar is told to us through the entire chapter of Genesis 38. You might put a bookmark in Genesis 38 because we're going to refer from time to time to that chapter. But let's take a look. In the previous chapter in Genesis 37, it's about Joseph, also the son of Jacob, who is the grandson of Isaac and great-grandson of Abraham. And Genesis 37 tells us about Joseph's dreams and how Joseph was sold in slavery to Egypt by his own brothers. The chapter after the story of Tamar is then Genesis 39. So we have Genesis 37 about Joseph, Genesis 38, the story of Tamar, and then Genesis 39, we're back to the story of Joseph's life in Egypt, including how Joseph rejected the illicit advances of the Egyptian Potiphar's wife and how Joseph wound up in prison. In other words, the events that occurred in chapter 38 about the story of Judah and Tamar is happening at the same time as the events that occurred in chapter 39, the story of Joseph in Egypt. And after we go through the story of Tamar, we'll come to see what a contrast the life of Judah was as compared to his much younger brother, Joseph. Tamar, the woman listed in Matthew 1, her life is inextricably connected and intertwined with the life of Judah. Judah, the son of Leah, and the fourth son of Jacob, was the grandson of Isaac and great-grandson of Abraham. We think of them as the patriarchs. Judah was able to convince his brothers that they should not kill their younger brother Joseph, and we read that in Genesis 37. It was Judah who suggested that the brothers could make some money by selling Joseph to some traveling traders. In Genesis 37, verse 26, Genesis 37, 26, we read, Judah said to his brethren, what profit is there if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, verse 27, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Incidentally, those were his cousins. And let's not our hand be upon him, for he's our brother in our flesh. and his brothers were content. So off Joseph went, sold, and off into Egypt. So Genesis 38 then sets the time frame for the story of Tamar. So let's take a look at Genesis 38, verse 1. And it came to pass at that time. Well, what time? That time was just after Joseph was cast into the pit, sold to the Ishmaelite traders, and transported to Egypt. And if we read on in Genesis 38 and verse 1, that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Hira the Adullamite will appear later in this story, so we'll want to make a mental note that Hira was Judah's friend. In Genesis 38, we go on to verse 2, and Judah saw a daughter of a Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went in to her. And this is where Judah took a wife of the local women of the land. And verse 3, and she conceived and bore a son. His name was Ur. She had another son. Next verse, his name was Onan. She had a third son and called his name Shelah. Now, it doesn't tell us exactly the ages of them. It sounds like it's one after the other, but there is, in fact, some age spread here. So Judah had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. In the Bible commentary by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, it notes that Judah did just like his uncle Esau, and he married outside of their religion into a Canaanite family, and that such a marriage was a major contributor to the problems that were to follow. And this then is where Tamar is introduced into this story. So what I want to do today is go through a timeline of the circumstances here in Tamar's life. And the first point in the Tamar is Judah arranged for Tamar to become the wife of his eldest son. Now, in Genesis 38, we read this, that Judah took a wife, 38 verse 6, and Judah took a wife for his firstborn. The wife was named Tamar, and Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. Now, exactly how that happened, we're not given the details. It could be that most likely he reaped the consequences of his own actions. Well, it was the custom of then that day that the fathers generally arranged the marriages for their children, and this was especially important for inheritance purposes. I offered to do that for my daughters, and they shrunk back just a little bit, the thought that I would arrange all of their marriages. So the first point in the timeline is that Judah arranged a marriage for Tamar to his eldest son. But then the eldest son, died. And the second point in the timeline, and we don't know how much time later, but it was later, obviously, that Judah arranged for Tamar to marry his second son, Onan. This arranged marriage, the second marriage, was according to the Levirate law, that if a man died without having a son, then the dead man's brother was to marry the widow and raise up a son to inherit his dead brother's then estate. And that's what happened in this case. There are two laws of inheritance here that are in play. One is the law of primogeniture, and that is where the firstborn either inherits everything or inherits a double portion. And the second law here is called the Levirate law of marriage, and we're going to step through these. So in number 2, about Judah arranging for Tamar to marry his second son Onan, we first take a look at the law of primogeniture. The right of the firstborn to inherit the entire estate, or in the case of the Hebrews, the eldest inherited a double portion. And this goes back to Deuteronomy 21. And starting in verse 15, we can go through that, that if a man have multiple children, the firstborn was to inherit. There's also an example of the parable of the prodigal son, and we look at that in Luke 15 and verse 11. And in this case, in Luke 15, 11, the prodigal son, which we often referred to, the youngest of the two sons, wanted his share of the estate early while he was yet young and alive. And so therefore, if there are two sons, if you read in Luke 15, verse 11, and a certain man had two sons, well, that means you take the number of sons, you add one portion, divide it by three, The oldest gets a double portion, the youngest gets a single portion. Verse 12, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that fall to me. That's pretty bold. How many of us go to our parents and say, you know, I think I'd like my inheritance now. Don't see that too often, but in this case, this is what happened. And look what the father did. He divided with them his living. He said, okay, double portion goes to the older one. The single portion goes to the younger one. And what was occurring here is that the father had reserved the double portion. So he divided his estate into those thirds, and the eldest got two-thirds, the youngest got a third, and then, of course, proceeded to blow his estate. The second principle here is the Levirate law of marriage. And the term Levirate is a derivative of the Latin term levir, meaning husband's brother or uncle. In Deuteronomy 25, we read in verses 5 through 10, we read about this principle of the Levirate law of marriage. In Deuteronomy 25, starting in verse 5, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without, meaning elsewhere, unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go to her and take her to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother. Verse 6, and it shall be the firstborn which she bears shall succeed in the name of the brother which is dead, and his name not be put out of Israel. So that was a responsibility then of the brother of the dead man to raise up a son in the brother's name. The Levirate principle and practice has been around for a long time, and the form of Levirate principle is practiced throughout Asia, Africa, many other cultures. It's happened in my family in past generations. This is not an uncommon thing in many cultures in the world. In the time of Jesus Christ, the Sadducees questioned Jesus Christ about using the Levirate law to challenge Christ regarding the resurrection. We read in Matthew 22, where the Sadducees said in Matthew 22 and verse 24, saying, Master, Moses said, if a man die and leaves no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up and send and seed to his brother. Well, then the following verses go on to describe a woman marrying seven successive brothers without having children. And then so whose wife is she in the resurrection? Kind of challenge. And of course, that's where we understand that there is not marriage in the resurrection. So we go back to the story of Tamar. And following then the Levirate custom, Judah instructed his second son, Omar, to marry the woman, the widow Tamar. And we read that in Genesis 38 and verse 8, as we scoot through Genesis 38. And verse 9, and Onan knew that the seed, the offspring, should not be his. And so at that point, he refused to have a son by Tamar, because that son would be reserved and would replace him as the one who would get the bulk of the inheritance of the father. We aren't given the particulars of Ur's death, but if we read in verse 10 that Onan also died because he refused to do so, and we aren't given the particulars of that. But so we are left to speculate why Onan did not want to have a son by Tamar, but it isn't a difficult speculation that Onan's son by Tamar would have been legally considered to be Ur's son and the primary heir to all that the grandfather Judah had possessed. Just as heir, the older brother would have been the heir to all that Ur had he remained alive. Basically, Onan would be relegated to a lesser inheritance if he had a son by Tamar. If we take a look, incidentally, at this time, Judah's father, Jacob, also named Israel, was still alive at that time. And Judah was in line to become the chief inheritor of Jacob's estate as well as his own. So that meant that Jacob or Israel's estate would have largely descended to Judah and then but Ur died, and then Onan, unless Onan had a son with Tamar. So Onan chose not to do so. There was a lot of money riding on the line for that decision, and Onan thought he would wait until, it appears from my observation, that he'd waited till his father died and go marry as he will and keep everything for himself. So it's reasonable to ask also, how does Judah, the fourth-born son, come to be the principal heir? I thought we just talked about the law of primogeniture. Well, we can go through a number of the stories that we are told in the Bible, in 1 Chronicles 5:1, where we read about how Reuben, the firstborn of Jacob or Israel, how he disqualified himself by moral depravity. Then we continue on in Genesis 34, in verse 20, starting in verse 25, we read how Simeon and Levi disqualified themselves from the inheritance by their behavior in the story of Dinah, their sister, where they slaughtered a number of Canaanites who desired to join the people of Israel and dedicated themselves to that, but the brothers Simeon and Levi killed them all anyway. And so they disqualified themselves. That left the fourth son, Judah. And so we'll leave the story of Dinah for another day. But suffice it to say that the Levi and Simeon had blood on their hands and were disqualified then from being Jacob's primary heir. And now this raises a particular issue. With Judah's eldest son, Er, dead and Er having no heir, and the second son, Onah, becoming the primary heir, and Onan didn't want to displace himself with a child by Tamar. So he refused to do so, and then Onan died. Well, let's stop and ask ourselves for a moment, well, why didn't Tamar just inherit her husband's portion? After all, isn't that what happens today? And it seems like that would have just settled the matter. That happens everywhere in the world today, but that's not how the world worked at that time. The wife was not the heir, and the right to marry Tamar was a legal issue, and that was to be decided by the husband's next of kin. In this case, her father-in-law would decide who would marry Tamar, who then would inherit his and indeed his father's inheritance. So that's what was in play here. Now, if we take a look, there's another well-known biblical example where the Levirate law of marriage was practiced, and the right to marry the widow was an inheritable right and involved real estate, and that is the Book of Ruth. We read the Book of Ruth, and particularly chapter 4, about Ruth and Boaz chose to do so, to marry Ruth, and then he gained the estate, the management of the estate of Ruth's deceased husband. And so if we take a look in Ruth chapter 4, we can read through that in verses 1 through 12. We can read that entire story. And now let's go down to where Ruth, in the story of Ruth and Boaz, in Ruth 4 and in verse 12, there was a blessing upon then the child that Ruth bore and their household. In verse 12, and let your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah, and the seed which the Lord shall give you of this young woman. There was similarity here between Tamar and Ruth regarding this Levirate law, and a direct reference then to Tamar in the book of Ruth. So that second point was Judah instructed his son Onan to marry Tamar, and he did, but refused to have a child with her. This third time point on the timeline is Judah told Tamar then to return to her own father's house. You go, well, there's three sons. Why would that be? The first two died. And if we read in Genesis 38, verse 11, we read Judah's instructions to his widow daughter-in-law. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at your father's house till Shelah, my son, be grown. So there was a third son, but he wasn't yet marriageable age. For he said, lest peradventure he die also as his brothers did. So Judah's kind of concerned. This woman is bad luck. First son married her, boom, dead. Second son married her, boom, dead. Not so sure he wants to entrust his third son to this woman. But what did Tamar do? We read in 38:11, Tamar went and dwelt in his father's house. So Tamar went home. She lived as a widow, and at the same time she was a betrothed woman in her own father's house. She was living in another world. She was neither married, nor was she free to contract another marriage. She was at once a widow and an engaged woman. The only place for her to live was then back in her father's household. So the fourth point on our timeline for Tamar was that she waited and waited and waited. But Judah did not arrange for Shelah to marry Tamar when Shelah reached adulthood. We read that in Genesis 38, verse 4. You see, adulthood is generally assumed to be age 20. We aren't given the exact number of years. It's possible that Tamar waited 10 years, could have waited 15 years, for Shelah to grow up to be a marriageable age. And just as we read in verse 11, Judah was worried his third son would die, just as the older two did. So he was a little nervous about ready to pull the trigger and initiate that wedding. In Genesis 38, verse 4, Judah did not arrange for Shelah to marry Tamar. Now, the Barnes notes on the Bible, he notes that the Hebrews could not marry prior to the age of 13. Well, I thought, well, that's convenient. But they were often expected to marry by the age of 20. And so this was a note. So we know that by the age of 20, there was an expectation of marriage. So by Judah delaying the marriage of his third son to Tamar, he then had delayed or prevented the eventual birth of a son by Tamar to inherit the portion reserved for Ur. In Exodus 22, verse 29, we read about this kind of delay. In Exodus 22, verse 29, you shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe fruits, of your liquors, the firstborn of your sons, shall you give to me. Well, we just had the Feast of First Fruits here a week ago. And the principle of firstborn, to first fruits, we'll bring up here later in this message. When Judah delayed the marriage of Shelah to Tamar, or let's say it the way it is, he didn't follow through on the agreement. He was condemning Tamar to a lifetime of widowhood and childlessness. And in so doing, Judah was condemning Tamar to poverty because she would inherit nothing and have no children to look after her in her old age. And in that sense, Judah was oppressing the widow Tamar. In Zechariah 7, and starting in verse 9, in Zechariah 7, verse 9, we read, thus speaks the Lord of hosts, saying, execute true judgment and show mercy and compassion, every man to his brother. Verse 10, and oppress not the widow, nor the fatherless, the stranger, nor the poor, and let none of you imagine evil against his brother in your heart. We also read in Exodus 22 and verse 40, in Exodus 22 and verse 40, you shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any wise, and they cry out at all to me, I will surely hear their cry. By delaying or denying the marriage of Shelah to Tamar, Judah was setting himself up then for a nasty fall. Let's go to the fifth point on the timeline of Tamar. The fifth point, during this time, Judah's wife died. In Genesis 38, verse 12, and in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shears in Timnath and to his friend Hira the Adullamite. Remember that name? Hira. Remember, Hira was the Adullamite was Judah's best friend from the same area where Judah had originally obtained his first wife. And we read about when we started chapter 38. If we go to Joshua 12 and verse 7 and 15, we read that Adullam was one of the 14 kingdoms that were defeated by Joshua when there was the conquest of the Israelites when they conquered Canaan. And then if we read in Joshua 15, verses 20 and 35, that very region was assigned to Judah. So we can understand how he was friends with the neighbor and married a woman from that area. So Judah's wife had died. That was on the timeline. That's timeline point five. Timeline point six. No marriage on the horizon. With no marriage on the horizon, and the legal right to bear the child who would be the heir of the substantial future estates of Judah and Jacob, Tamar became impatient and decided to take matters into her own hands. In Genesis 38, verse 14, and she put the widow's garments off from her and covered herself with a veil, wrapped herself and sat in an open place by the way, which is, by the way, on the way to Timnath, for she saw that Shelah was growing and she was not given to him to wife. So we have this scheme set in motion. Tamar knew that there was an expectation. She knew that Judah had promised her then a husband. She knew she had the legal right to bear the inheritor of Judah's estate. And Tamar determined if she wasn't going to marry Judah's third son, Shelah, she would find another way to become pregnant and bear a son to inherit Judah's and Jacob's estates. In Genesis 38, verse 13, and it was told Tamar, saying, behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnath to shear his sheep. So the word is out. She knew where he was going. She knew when he was going. Now, if we take a look at the Bible commentary of Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the sheep shearing season in that area occurred near the end of March. The sheep shearing season was a time when the owners invited their friends and servants and treated them to dining and parties after each hard day's work. I recall this growing up on the farm during harvest season where the neighbors would help each other. And at the end of a long, hard day, everybody would feast together. No matter how late in the day it was, you'd finally get a chance to sit down, have dinner, and then the next day would start all over. And when they were done harvesting in one place, they would move to the next and so forth. And I can see how this has been a custom for thousands of years. So they were going to have, he was going there. It was much a work event as it was a social occasion. So now we read on in Genesis 38, and we read earlier in verse 14 that she was going to sit by the way and disguise herself. In verse 15, when Judah saw her, meaning saw Tamar, he thought her to be a harlot because she had covered her face. Now, you'd think that Judah would have recognized Tamar. After all, he had to have known her fairly well. She was his daughter-in-law twice. He had arranged for her to marry his eldest son, then his second son. But if after the death of the second son, he had instructed her then to go home to live with his father, it's possible that he hadn't seen her for 10 years, maybe 15 years. It was some time. And it might even have been almost 20 years. But Tamar went back to her father's household. And of course, Tamar's face was covered with a veil. Judah's wife had died. So he did not have that companionship. And in verse 16, we read on. And we read this story then in Genesis 38, verse 16, is where Judah bargained with Tamar for a dalliance. And if we notice there, when Tamar is also bargained with Judah, they bargained back and forth. And if we read Genesis 38, 14, he turned to her, by the way, and said, go, I pray you, let me come to you, for he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? And he said, I will send you a kid from the flock. And she said, will you give me a pledge until you send it? Verse 18. And he said, what pledge shall I give you? And she said, your signet, your bracelets, and your staff that's in your hand. And he gave it to her and came into her, and she conceived by him. Now, Tamar was determined, and she had to have known that she was fertile, and that was her time, because she was ready. And she also needed proof that Jacob was the father of that potential child. I went to my old college textbook that I had in Old Testament survey class. It was a book called The Old Testament Speaks, a commentary by Samuel Schultz. And Schultz makes the notes that ancient Ugaritic and Mesopotamian sources that there were three items required for personal identification. And this is what Tamar did. She obtained Judah's signet. Now, we don't know if that was the ring off of his hand or if it was by a chain or a rope around his neck, but it was to be placed on a legal document. We don't know, but we do know it was his signet, his bracelets, and his staff. And each of these are personalized identification in some manner so that others would recognize those things. And Tamar's efforts were to get those three items of collateral to back up Judah's pledges, not much different than what we have to do when we go to get a driver's license. You've got to show up. You've got to have several pieces of ID. They just don't go and take your word for it. Same thing as if you're applying for a Social Security card. Again, several pieces of identification. We turn to Exodus 22 and verse 26. There are societal rules for the regarding of taking pledges. Example, the pledge of personal property as a coat can't be retained overnight. Somebody would really need their coat overnight. So let's read in Exodus 22, if you take all of your neighbor's raiment to pledge, you shall deliver it to him by time the sun goes down. So this is attended to. There's a scriptural principle. In other words, it's only for a temporary time. And then if, so Judah most likely would presume that the pledge was to be redeemed quickly. Of course, Judah may also have come to his senses and realized that his identification was kind of out there in someone else's possession, and it was in his own best interest to pay off and get his items back quickly before he would be publicly embarrassed. So Genesis 38, verse 19, and she, meaning Tamar, rose and went away and laid by her veil from her and put on the garments of widowhood. She resumed her widow's garments, and Judah, verse 20, sent the kid by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge. Now, who else could he trust? Here was his best friend from the past, 30 plus years? And here, would you take care of this mess for me a little bit? I promise this. Go get my stuff back. You'll know what it is. And do this. In other words, let's clean this up. So what did his friend, Hira the Adullamite, say in verse 21? And he asked the men of that place, where's the harlot who was openly by the wayside? And they said, there's no harlot in this place. They were somewhat surprised by this. And so the Adullamite returned, verse 22, to Judah and said, I can't find her. And also the men of the place said, there's no harlot there. Verse 23 said, and Judah said, let her take it to her, lest we be shamed. Therefore, I sent this kid, and I've not found her. In other words, he wanted to be known. He meant to satisfy the obligation. But Judah trusted his friend Hira the Adullamite to keep it quiet. And apparently he did. So this young goat was payment for the services, was never picked up. Even if Judah knew who had held his pledge items, he couldn't very well go and demand to get the items back, because that in itself would have been very revealing. It was also not the custom to search out a pledge to redeem the items. We read in Deuteronomy 24, starting in verse 10, and it talks about what happens if someone has a pledge and or collateral. In verse 10, when you do lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to fetch his pledge. You shall stand abroad or outside, and the man to whom you do lend shall bring out the pledge to you. So it wasn't appropriate for him to, even if he knew who she was, which apparently he did not, you can't go just take it back and say, here it is. So let's go to point 7 then on the timeline for Tamar's life. Tamar's pregnancy was discovered and Judah condemned her to death. Tamar's pregnancy was discovered and Judah condemned her to death. If we read in Genesis 38, verse 24, it came to pass about 3 months after it was told to Judah, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot, and also behold, she's child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burned. Well, it's a responsibility of the head of the household to make sure everything goes well. Everybody follows the law. It's also interesting that Judah ordered Tamar to be burnt. According to the Cambridge Bible commentary, the death penalty by burning was only done to a daughter of the priest, whereas a death penalty by stoning was the method used by everyone else. If we read in Leviticus 21 and verse 9, and the daughter of any priest, if she profane herself by playing the whore, she profanes her father, and she shall be burnt with fire. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that it was a priest in Israel, but he may have been a pagan priest. We aren't told. But burning an adulteress was an ancient punishment under the ancient code of Hammurabi, which was the Babylonian law and the consequence of that. But in short, Judah set up Tamar to be judged at a higher standard than his own behavior, a standard that was reserved, the harshest standard reserved for priests, by declaring that Tamar, being pregnant out of wedlock, must be burned rather than stoned. Well, according to the Bible commentary by Schultz, burning a common harlot was practiced by the Hittites and the Philistines of that region. We read that evidence of that in Judges 15 and verse 6 about Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite. He had taken his wife and given her to his companion, and the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. So there is this other evidence that this sort of thing does happen. Schultz's commentary goes on to point out that the fulfillment of the Levirate obligations by the father-in-law in marrying the widow daughter-in-law was allowed among the Hittites, but it wasn't a practice under the Israelites. So accordingly, Tamar was not subject to the punishment under local law for the deception of Judah. So in her, the way she was raised, that was perfectly normal. Regardless of how the death penalty was supposed to be carried out, the judgment conflicted with the principle that a pregnant woman could not be put to death because that would kill an innocent life of the baby. In Genesis 38, verse 25, when she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law saying, "By the man whose these are, I am with child." And she said, "Discern, I pray you, whose are these, the signet, the bracelets, and the staff?" Verse 26, and Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son," and he knew her again no more. Judah was openly embarrassed, and he was shamed by the revelation that he then was the father of Tamar's pregnancy. He had just gotten through condemning Tamar to a horrible death to be burned, and he openly confessed that by comparison with Judah, Tamar was more honorable than himself, who consorted then with what he thought to be a harlot. Further, as the facts became known, Tamar had the legal right to bear Judah's heir, but it was Judah who acted dishonorably. Judah noted correctly that he was under greater condemnation. And, of course, there would be a child forthcoming to remind Judah and everyone else of his indiscretion for the rest of his life. I also note that Judah didn't marry Tamar. Although he did take responsibility for her and the care of her children, in the in Hebraic law, he was forbidden from marrying his daughter-in-law. In Leviticus 20 and verse 12, we read, "If a man lie with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall be surely put to death. They shall have wrought confusion, and their blood shall be upon them." So he now had a little closer attention to what he should be doing and how he should be doing it. Let's go to point 8 on the timeline of Tamar's life. And point 8 is, Tamar had twin sons, one son to replace each of Judah's eldest dead sons, Ur and Onan. We read in Genesis 38, verse 27, "It came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in the womb." Now let's stop and do the math. It's possible, or perhaps even probable, that Tamar was age 35 or even 40 at the time she became pregnant. She had married two successive husbands who had both died. She waited possibly 10 years or more for Judah's third son to grow up, and the likelihood for twins is three times greater than normal for a mother who is 35 years of age or older. The age difference between Tamar and Shelah may have been why it was unseemly in Shelah's mind to marry the older Tamar, whereas he would have been possibly around age 20, and Tamar may have been closer to age 40. And then there were these unusual circumstances. about the birth of Tamar's twin sons. And we read that in Genesis 38, verse 28. And it came to pass when she travailed, she was giving birth, that one of the babies put out his hand. The midwife took it, put in his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this one came out first. Verse 29, it came to pass, he drew back his hand, and behold, his brother came out. And she said, how have you broken forth? But afterwards out came his brother, and they had this scarlet thread upon his hand. So you have two of them with a claim to being firstborn. Well, the first time I read about that unusual circumstance, I couldn't help but wonder what it was all about. But it was recorded for us to know. It had to have a meaning. And the answer lies in understanding the inheritance laws. Because there was confusion in the birthing process, which of the sons was firstborn, each of the twin sons would have some claim to being firstborn. And this was important because of then the law of primogeniture, the firstborn inheriting a double portion. By the birth of twins, Judah's original third son was displaced by both of those babies, a replacement for Ur and a replacement for Onan. Shelah was no longer the chief inheritor, but he had slipped back into third place behind his two baby half-brothers. Had Judah kept his word and honored the Levirate marriage law, Judah's third son would have taken Tamar as a wife, and if Tamar had born Shelah's son, then that son would have accounted for inheritance purposes of the child of Judah's eldest son, Ur. However, the third son, Shelah, didn't marry Tamar, and the rest, they say, is history. Later, in an apparent attempt to gain Judah's estate for his own son, should it be possible, we read in 1 Chronicles 4, verse 21, that Shelah named his first son Ur, the name of his eldest brother. The uncle and nephew then carried this same name. Now, this practice of naming children after their uncles is a common practice, been around a long time, perhaps thousands of years. I was often puzzled in the neighborhood where I grew up. My dad explained to me it was an old German custom of naming nephews after their uncles. I remember two Ed Ottos. There was old Ed and young Ed. And then there was two Henry Ottos, young Henry and old Henry. Although they were all old to me when I was a kid, but everybody referred to them, uncle and nephew, that way. Incidentally, the sons of Shelah, the third son of Judah, his sons had to have been born later in Egypt after the tribe of Israel went down to Egypt at the time of Joseph. And so we know this because the entire listing of Jacob's offspring, including sons and grandsons, were specifically counted and named. And Shelah's sons were not named as traveling to Egypt. So it appears then that they were born later in Egypt. And point nine on the timeline, we read between the lines and discover that if Tamar was still alive, we are left to presume that she went to Egypt with Judah and Judah's household with her sons. And by that time, we read that her twin sons had their own children, and she would have been a grandmother. In Numbers 26, verse 19, we read about the listing of those who went to Egypt. I'm not going to go through the list, but Tamar's twin sons are on that list. So what kind of lessons do we have? We've gone through this story. We've gone through 9 points on the timeline of the life of Tamar. So what can we derive from this? Of what value is it for us? Why is this recorded for our benefit? Well, let's go to point one under lessons from the life of Tamar. And point one is God the Father is the author of our calling. Judah, as a physical example, was the father who arranged the marriage for his sons. He initially chose Tamar to be the mother of his descendants. Judah reinforced that calling when he instructed Tamar to marry his second son, and then later contracted her to marry his third son. So she was called to be the mother of Judah's heir, and she was chosen then to become to be welcomed into the tribe of Israel. Well, similarly, God the Father chose us to be in his kingdom. Most of us have memorized John 6:44. No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me to draw him, and I will raise him up on the last day. We also read in Acts 2 and verse 39 and Acts 2:39, "For the promise is to you and to your children and to all that are afar off, as many as the Lord our God shall call." So it's God that's doing the calling. And we have then become chosen to become members of the spiritual tribe of Israel. The Apostle Paul was writing to the Galatians, and he referred to converted people as being part of the Israel of God. It's regardless of our actual biological ancestry in Galatians 6:15. In Galatians 6:15, "For in Jesus Christ neither circumcision avails anything nor uncircumcision, but a new creature or creation." Verse 16, "And as many walk according to this rule, peace be on them and mercy and upon the Israel of God." But Judah, unlike Judah, God actually keeps his word. In Psalm 119, 160, "The word is true from the beginning. Every one of your righteous judgments endure forever." When Judah gave his word, he didn't keep it. When God gives his word, by Psalm 119:160, he kept it. So the first point is God the Father is the author of our calling. The second point is we are to hold fast to our calling. We are to hold fast to our calling. Now, to her credit, Tamar hung on to her calling, but it was imperfect and impatient. We are to hold on to our calling. In Job 27, verse 6, in Job 27, verse 6, "My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me so long as I live." We also read in Hebrews 10, in verse 23, in Hebrews 10, 23, "Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that has promised." And finally, we read in 2 Peter 1:10, in 2 Peter 1:10, "Wherefore, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure, for if we do these things, we shall never fail." So the second point here on our lessons are we're to hold fast to our calling, have a tight grip on our calling. Point three of the lessons is we are part of an arranged marriage. We are part of an arranged marriage. Now, Judah selected and arranged for Tamar to be the bride of his sons. This is a physical prototype of God's arrangement for us. Christ gave this example in Matthew 22 and verse 2. In Matthew 22, verse 2, "The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king which made a marriage for his son." And then we go on to Matthew 25, and starting in verse 1, and I'm not going to go through it, we have the parable of the bridesmaids and being arranged for the bridegroom. But I do want to read in Revelation 19 and verse 7, in Revelation 19, 7. "Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and the wife has made herself ready." And verse 9, "And he said unto me, Write, blessed are they which are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, These are the true sayings of God." So in this sense, we are part of an arranged marriage, just as Judah arranged the marriages for his sons. The fourth lesson that we come from the story of Tamar is God emphasizes the importance of the firstborn and his inheritance. God emphasizes the importance of the firstborn and his inheritance. The emphasis on the firstborn is a physical prototype, a forerunner of what was going to happen spiritually, that Jesus Christ was going to be the firstborn of many brethren. We read in Exodus 34 in verse 19 that the firstborn belonged to God. Exodus 34, verse 19, "All that opened the matrix is mine, and every firstling among the cattle, ox, or sheep is male." And it goes through and explains the value of the firstborn that belongs to God. And Jesus Christ, of course, was the first of the firstborn in his immediate human family, as we read when we go through the story of his mother Mary. But most importantly, Jesus Christ was the firstborn person from the dead, the first person into a new resurrection, and therefore the hope and the destiny of mankind. We read in Colossians 1 and verse 18. In Colossians 1:18, we read, He is the head of the body, speaking of Christ, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, and that in all things he might have preeminence. But he's the first of the firstborn. There is also a church of the firstborn. And we read that in Hebrews 12:23. In Hebrews 12:23, the church of God is called the church of the firstborn, with this saying, to the general assembly and the church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. As church of the firstborn, we can be part of the first resurrection. The writer in Hebrews 11:35 has a special term for the potential for those who are in the first resurrection. In Hebrews 11:35, women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. So we know there's more than one, but that first resurrection is called a better resurrection. It's clearly spelled out, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, in 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 16, about the resurrection of the saints upon the return of Christ at the onset of Christ's return and the ushering in of the kingdom of God. But we do go to Colossians 1 and verse 15. There's a couple of verses there I want to cover in Colossians 1 and 15, because the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Colossus about Christ being the firstborn of the dead, the firstborn of the spiritual resurrection, in Colossians 1, 15. Who is in the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature? For by him were all things created that are in heaven, that are on earth, visible and invisible. And verse 18, and he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have preeminence. God places a value on our calling, and our own determination makes our calling sure, on the understanding that we are part of that arranged marriage with Jesus Christ, and that we'll be among the firstborn of the family of God. Well, the story of Tamar prepares us to understand two chapters in the New Testament and that particularly speak to the understanding of salvation. And I would encourage you, indeed, assign us all to read both of those chapters, Ephesians 1 and Hebrews 1. Both of those chapters, let's read them both with the understanding of the inheritance that we've learned from the story of Tamar. The lessons from Tamar, that God the Father is the author of our calling. Secondly, that we must hold fast to that calling. Third, we'll be part of an arranged marriage. Fourth, that God emphasizes the importance of the firstborn and his inheritance. We all hope to become heirs of God, to be counted as firstborn with Jesus Christ, and then to inherit eternal life in the kingdom of God.